Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about coordination problems, which will constitute our first answer to the question, why isn't there more cooperation between states? On the first slide, I lay out the two goals of this lecture. First, I will provide you with a general understanding of coordination problems, using a game theoretic model that is somewhat more sophisticated than any of the ones you saw in the lecture on game theory, but is still fairly simple. Second, I will provide two real-world examples of coordination problems getting in the way of cooperation between states. Cooperation that, for reasons discussed in the lecture on foregone benefits, we can be sure would benefit all states involved overall, if not necessarily every single person inside those states. On the second slide, you'll find a model of coordination that is similar in many respects to the normal form game you saw in the lecture on game theory, but which also has a few key differences. We still have two players deciding between two options, but those options are different, as are the payoffs. Here, we continue to assume that some form of cooperation is always preferred to none, but we allow the players to disagree about which strategy it would be best for them to both select. Unlike in the Stag Hunt game, where the only truly cooperative strategy involved both players working together to bring down a stag. When they both selected the strategy of hare, that meant they were hunting separate animals. Suppose our two players are students at Essex, who don't know each other too well, but are hoping to run into each other on Friday night. And we assume that they either haven't exchanged contact information yet, or, if they have, that they don't feel comfortable using it. So they aren't going to explicitly coordinate with one another. They have to instead decide where to go on their own and just hope the other person is there. As I've said, though, they disagree about what the best outcome would be. For player one, it would be for them to run into each other at top bar. For two, at sub-zero. The way that's reflected in the payoffs is that I've given each player some amount of benefit, represented by beta, whenever they choose the same strategy, and a zero whenever they do not. But the specific version of beta they receive depends on where they end up. Incidentally, anytime you see me use a beta in this module, that's that Greek letter that sort of looks like the letter P, it will stand for the benefit of cooperation. And anything with a line over it will always be bigger than the same symbol with a line under it. So, player 1 gets a big benefit if both player 1 and player 2 go to top bar, and a small benefit if both of them go to sub-zero. Player 2 gets a big benefit if both of them go to sub-zero, and a smaller one if they both go to top bar. I could have given each player a negative payoff for the outcome where they go somewhere they don't really like and the other person's not there. The substantive story I've told implies that would be a bit worse than failing to run into them at the other place, because that's at least more their scene. But drawing finer distinctions amongst the bad outcomes wouldn't really add any insight, and it would complicate things. Not much, but it would. So let's just keep it simple and give each of them zeros anytime they fail to run into one another. So, that's the model. Two students hope to run into each other, and either can't or won't make things easy by sending the other an SMS or messaging them on Facebook or whatever. player 1 would prefer to run into player 2 at top bar, while player 2 would prefer to run into player 1 at sub-zero. But neither cares so much about the choice of venue that they'd want to go to the place that they like better if they somehow knew for a fact that the other person wouldn't be there. They're really hoping to see each other. Got all that? If not, you might want to start the lecture over. Unlike previous game theoretic models we've discussed, I'm taking you through this one because I think it actually tells us something about international relations, and you're going to have to know some things about it as a result, even though it is a bit more advanced than the models you've seen so far. Obviously, the story I'm telling at the moment isn't about international relations. I'm trying to ease you into things a little bit by making this more relatable. But by the end of the lecture, it should be clear that the problem our students face is one that keeps states from reaping all the benefits of economic cooperation. So it really is important that you follow along. You will be asked questions about this model, its assumptions, the conditions under which we expect different outcomes, etc., on the first test. So, like I said, if you weren't really paying attention so far, you might want to start over. Okay, let's move on and talk about equilibria. As I discussed in the lecture on game theory, with normal form games, there's no particular technique to finding equilibria. The handful of you who may have been exposed to game theory before know that there sort of is iterated elimination of strictly dominated strategies, but that doesn't always help, and I don't want to make this more complicated than it needs to be for your classmates. So, what we have to do is check each of the four possibilities, one at a time, for incentives to unilaterally deviate. Remember, player one controls which row we're in. They can move up and down, but that's it. While player two controls which column we're in, they can move left and right. If the payoff player one would receive by switching rows is higher than the one in the cell we're looking at, the outcome associated with that cell is not in equilibrium. Similarly, if player 2's utility would increase if they were to switch to the other column, staying in the same row, only player 1 gets to control that part, then we don't have an equilibrium. If neither player can get more of what they want by changing the one thing they actually have control over, that's their individual behavior, then we do have an equilibrium, and that's an outcome that would be stable. It's not guaranteed to occur, since there might be more than one equilibrium, but it's at least a strong possibility. In contrast, combinations of strategies that do not constitute equilibria aren't expected to occur too often, assuming we've captured the critical details with our model. We're rarely so confident about the model's fit to reality that we'd say non-equilibrium outcomes are impossible in reality, but they should be rare. So, what are the equilibria here? You might want to hit pause and take a moment to see if you can figure it out for yourself. It's not too hard. Just remember, both beta underline and beta overline are positive, but the latter is bigger than the former. Hopefully, it wasn't too hard for you to see that there are two equilibria. One where both players go to top bar, and one where both go to sub-zero. If you gave it your best and didn't come up with that answer, something's seriously wrong and you should contact me. We may need to sit down and go over things one-on-one. Doesn't sound like we have too much of a problem yet, does it? But we do. obviously, or I wouldn't have titled the lecture Coordination Problems. However, now is a good time to discuss one of the key features of coordination problems. If players do arrive at a cooperative outcome, they will stay there. Nobody has an incentive to change their behavior. That is not the case with collaboration problems, which we'll discuss in the next lecture. That's an important distinction, and you should expect me to ask about it on the first test. So let me say it again, a little differently. When we have a coordination problem, the problem isn't that cooperation is unstable, it's that it might not occur in the first place. Collaboration problems are worse, because they not only make it unlikely that we'll get to a cooperative outcome, but also ensure that cooperation will unravel, even if it occurs. Turn to the next slide, where we'll see this a little more clearly. As it says on the first bullet point, suppose that player 1 is trying to guess what player 2 is likely to do, and figures the probability of them going to sub-zero is P2. We can now compare player 1's expected utility for going to sub-zero to player 1's expected utility for going to top bar. If they go to sub-zero, there's some chance that player 2 will also be there. By definition, the probability of that happening is P2, and that they'll therefore receive beta underline. So the first part of their expected utility accounts for that by multiplying the beta underline they get if player 2 is there by the probability of that happening, which is P2. The other thing that might happen, of course, is that player 2 isn't there. In that case, player 1 gets a 0. And technically, we've got to multiply that 0 by the probability of the outcome with which it's associated occurring, or 1 minus P2. But obviously, that doesn't really matter, because anything multiplied by 0 is just 0, and this part is going to drop out. If you're wondering why I've written things the way I have, though, that's the answer. Remember, expected utilities take into account how happy a player would be with each of the possible outcomes, weighted by how likely those outcomes are to occur. Here, we have two outcomes. Player 2 is also there, or they're not, and we multiply the payoffs associated with them, beta underline and 0, respectively, by their probabilities of occurring, P2 and 1 minus P2. On the right-hand side, which represents the expected utility of going to top bar, we have something similar, though the 0 is now attached to P2, because again, P2 is defined as the probability that player 2 decides to go to sub-zero. So if player 1 goes to top bar and player 2 goes to sub-zero, they won't run into each other and player 1 will get a 0. But that might not happen. There's a chance that player 2 also goes to top bar. And since I've implicitly assumed that there's nowhere else for player 2 to go, and there's no way they're staying in, the probability of that is simply the probability that they don't go to sub-zero, or 1 minus P2. If that happens, player 1 gets beta overline. Again, anytime we need to calculate an expected utility, we multiply the payoff the player receives at each possible outcome by the probabilities associated with those outcomes and add it all together. So, player 1 will get a 0 if player 2 goes to sub-zero, and the probability of that, by definition, is P2. whereas player 1 gets beta over line, which is the best possible outcome in this game for player 1, if player 2 goes to top bar, which they do with probability 1 minus p2. That's why the right side looks as it does. After some simple algebra, which I'm not even going to put on the slides anymore, we arrive at the conclusion that player 1's expected utility for going to sub-zero is greater than their expected utility for going to top bar, when p2, their best guess of how likely it is that player 2 will go to sub-zero, is greater than p2 hat, where p2 hat is equivalent to beta overline over the sum of the two betas. That is, I've created a new symbol here whose sole purpose for existing is to help us figure out when player 1 prefers one strategy to the other. And I've named it, partially, after the symbol we need to compare to it in order to answer that question. I've also put a hat on it so that you know it's a cut point. In plain English, the more likely it is in player 1's mind that player 2 will end up at sub-zero, the more player 1 wants to go there. Exactly how likely it needs to be before they'll decide to head there depends on the size of the betas. If player 1 only has a very slight preference for top bar, that is, if beta overline is only a little bit bigger than beta underline, then p2 hat will be very close to 0.5. The more strongly player 1 prefers top bar, though, the more confident they need to be that going there is going to mean missing out on a chance to run into player 2 before they'll talk themselves out of it and go to sub-zero instead. Let's use some actual numbers to illustrate that. Suppose beta underline is 2, and beta overline is 2.5. Then p2 hat will be 2.5 over 4.5, which is approximately 0.56. In that case, if player 1 thinks there's, say, a 60% chance that player 2 will end up at sub-zero, then that's where they're going to go. Now, bump beta overline up to 4. p2 hat now becomes 4 over 6, which is approximately 0.67. Now, if player 1 thinks there's a 60% chance that player 2 will end up at sub-zero, they're going to go to top bar. They realize that means there's a pretty good chance they'll miss out on seeing player 2, but they're okay with that. I haven't shown you the algebra that gets us there, but if you followed everything up to this point, you shouldn't be surprised to hear me say that we can figure out which choice is best for player 2 in a very similar way. We'll use P1 to stand for how likely player 2 thinks it is that player 1 will go to sub-zero, and compare that to a cut point named P1 hat to determine whether player 2's expected utility for going to sub-zero is greater than or equal to their expected utility for going to top bar. A quick aside about a really minor issue that I'm sure some of you are wondering about. I've used greater than or equal to here, but just greater than above. Strictly speaking, when a player expects to get exactly as much utility from one strategy as another, they have no real preference, and their choice of strategy is entirely arbitrary. Those situations are so rare, some might even say they never occur, that it doesn't really matter what we say will happen in that situation. We could even say that it's purely random, I suppose. But the convention that most game theorists follow is to default to the outcome that seems to make just a smidge more sense. Since player 1 doesn't really like sub-zero, I implicitly assumed that if their expected utility for going there was exactly the same as their expected utility for going to top bar, they'd go to top bar. Player 2, on the other hand, likes Sub-Zero, so they don't need to expect to get more utility from going there, just as long as they don't get less. If you didn't follow that, don't worry. I'm never going to ask test questions about when we use strict versus weak inequalities. That was just in case anyone was curious, because people have asked about that in the past. Note that P1 hat is smaller than P2 hat. There's a reason for that. Player 2 likes Sub-Zero, whereas player 1 doesn't really. So player 1 needs to be fairly sure that's where player 2 is going before they'll decide to go there themselves. Player 2 doesn't need to be as optimistic about player 1 heading to Sub-Zero before they'll decide to go there. Let's use the same numbers from above. When beta underline is 2 and beta overline is 2.5, player 2 chooses Sub-Zero over top bar so long as they think there's at least a 44.4% chance of player 1 also being at Sub-Zero. And when we bump beta overline up to 4, they become willing to pick Sub-Zero as long as there's a 1 in 3 chance of running into player 1 there. Put simply, player 2's bar for heading to Sub-Zero is lower because they like Sub-Zero more. Makes sense, doesn't it? On the next slide, you find a visual summary of the results. Player 1's estimate of how likely it is that player 2 will go to Sub-Zero, which you'll recall is represented by P2, runs along the horizontal axis. Player 2's estimate of how likely it is that player 1 will go to Sub-Zero is on the vertical axis. So if both of them think it's very likely that the other will go to Sub-Zero, we'd be near the upper right corner. Whereas if they both thought the other was very likely to go to top bar, we'd be near the lower left corner, or the origin. The dashed lines separate regions where different outcomes occur in equilibrium. I've marked both cut points on each axis just for your reference. P1 hat only matters for player 2, and P2 hat only matters for player 1. So if it looks like the region with the Sub-Zero logo in it is taller than it is wide, while the region with the top bar logo is wider than it is tall, that's not just because of my poor graphic design skills. It's supposed to look that way. What that tells us is that both players end up at Sub-Zero when P2 is above P2 hat, which is a relatively strict condition, and P1 is above P1 hat, which is not. And both players end up at top bar when P2 is below P2 hat, which is true for a relatively wide range of values for P2, and P1 is below P1 hat, which is only true for a narrow range of values of P1. I've put frowny faces in the other regions, because if the player's beliefs take on values that put us there, their optimal behavior is going to have them heading to different establishments and they won't run into each other. For example, in the lower right, player 1 would think it's so likely that player 2 is going to Sub-Zero that they're going to go there as well, even though it's not their favorite place. Tragically, however, player 2 will have decided to go to top bar, and will have done so purely because they expect to find player 1 there. Hopefully now the problem is a little more clear. Whenever we have two or more players who stand to benefit from doing the same thing, but who have different preferences over the outcomes they could coordinate on, there's going to be more than one equilibrium, but no obvious best equilibrium. And if the players can't communicate with one another, and thus must try to guess what the other will do, there's no guarantee things will work out. They may miss out on some benefits. It's not because they don't see cooperation as being in their interest. If they reached a cooperative outcome, both would be happy to stick with it. No one's trying to take advantage of anyone or anything like that. It's just that sometimes it's hard to get to the happy place. That's especially true if they don't have clear expectations about how the other will behave, and if it makes a big difference to them whether they get the smaller or the bigger benefit of cooperation. That states might miss out on the benefits of cooperation for this reason isn't intuitive to everyone. A lot of people argue that the reason states don't cooperate more than they do is because it's just not in their interest to do so, which I argued in the first lecture really can't be the answer. But there's good reason to believe this explanation applies to international cooperation the same way it does our daily lives. In just a moment, I'm going to discuss two examples. But first, let me acknowledge that this is not the hardest problem to solve. I'm not saying that coordination problems are the primary reason states leave money lying on the ground. I don't think they are. But they are part of the story, and worth being aware of. Not just in their own right, though that's a perfectly good reason for this lecture to exist, but also because some of the arguments I'll present in the future take their existence, or potential existence, for granted. Okay, turn to the last slide. One example of how states used to miss out on the benefits of cooperation due to a coordination problem is trade in organic food. I'm referring specifically here to the US and the EU. Each has a different standard for determining what food can be labeled as organic. And prior to 2012, they insisted that any produce that was imported meet their own standards. So if farmers in the US wanted to export some of their produce to the EU, they not only had to get organic certification in the US, they had to get separate certification in Europe, and vice versa. Many farmers decided it wasn't worth it. The organic food market, while growing, isn't that big, and the certification process can be a real hassle. So there was money to be made, and more options could have been available to us as consumers at lower prices, but it wasn't happening because governments on both sides of the Atlantic put red tape in the way. Then an agreement was signed in 2012 whereby the US pledged to recognize EU certifications, and the EU pledged to do the same. Now, US farmers who want to sell organic food only have to go through one certification process, whether some of it's going to get exported to Europe or not. Similarly, EU farmers can have their produce sold in the US under the organic label so long as they went through the certification process in Europe. Good news for everyone. Well, sorta. It's not clear to me that the US and the EU should be in the agriculture business at all, as I discussed in the lecture on foregone benefits of cooperation. The rest of the world would be happy to see the market for their organic produce expand, while the US and EU focused on developing better, faster, cheaper mobile phones and commercial aircraft or whatever. But as long as the US and EU agricultural sectors remain as large as they are, removing barriers to trade between the two is preferable to leaving them in place, at least for their respective economies. The other example is the absence of a universal format for certain consumer goods, which in some cases prevents products from being sold overseas, and in other cases, ensures that the price at which they're sold is higher than it otherwise would be. Think, for example, about DVDs and how there's different formats for different regions. If an independent movie gets made in the US, one that doesn't appeal to everyone but gets really good reviews from critics, the distributor has to think about whether it's worth paying the extra cost to have the DVD made available in all the different regions. In many cases, they'll decide it's not. But if simply ordering more copies in the same format would allow them to distribute the movie in Europe and the rest of the world as well as the US, maybe they would. So if we could all coordinate on one format, everyone would have a wider selection of DVDs to purchase, and that would probably filter upstream enough to ensure a wider range of movies get made in the first place, given how important DVD sales still are to that industry. For now. It's only a matter of time before DVD goes the way of VHS. Or consider the fact that the UK, North America, and continental Europe all have different electric outlets. That makes it more difficult to import or export household electronics. How much trade is that costing us? Probably not a great deal. But like I said just a little earlier, I'm not trying to convince you that coordination problems are the primary reason states leave money lying on the ground, because I don't think they are. Hopefully, though, you now have a better sense of why states might sometimes fail to cooperate, even when doing so would benefit every state as a whole, while hurting none of them overall. That's something we're going to talk quite a bit more about. And you'll hear me talk about coordination problems again, too. That is all I have to say about them for now, though.